submission of protection by Mail and Guardian, and a number of things in that said to be concluded or to be this or to be that. I just want to know if this is indeed the final document from them, which I can utilize for purposes of dealing with this bill.
Because some of the conditions for some of the school nutrition program coordination processes is too strict and too difficult for some of the, so we suggested that there should be some relaxing around those issues. But the document is available if you want to go to one. So why do you want to take some of the answers?
No, we sent, because there was a very tight deadline, we sent and we were told that we had to sketch out the basis of our submission and then send a final submission. So that's not the final submission. All of those recommendations were included. So you don't have the correct document. I have one copy. I think it's important because we made specific recommendations to deal with our concerns in each and every case, and I think it's important that the committee members have access to that.
I just want to establish whether this document is in fact present, given to us, because I also have a document called draft submission.
Yes, it was checked.
Dr. Quinn.
May I suggest that they'll add to the draft. That's why they're here, to give an oral submission instead of waiting for the new document. Let's listen to them.
I agree with you. So, Mail and Guardian, have they taken your document?
No, I've taken my document. I know I've won.
Your friends have got copies of your document. So can we proceed on the same basis then?
Yes, that's fine, Chair. I hope this is not going to take out of my 7 minutes, but anyway, we're used to deadlines and used to keeping things within limits of space, so I don't think we'll have a problem. We can't say that this bill is a wolf in sheep's clothing. We accept that its intentions are honourable. But perhaps it's more accurate to say that the bill is an elephant dressed up as a sheep. From a distance, it looks relatively benign. But up closer, you realise it's going to develop into something very large and unmanageable with the potential to do a great deal of damage. We've dealt with that potential for harm in detail in our submission. But we'd like to highlight a few concerns for discussion with the committee. Both democracy and the media, to function properly, need and rely on the free flow of information, and perhaps especially of sensitive information. This bill will have an unwarranted and restrictive effect on the flow of information in several key ways. Firstly, through chronic overclassification. Secondly, through safeguards that are largely symbolic rather than practical. Thirdly, through adopting a sledgehammer approach to criminalizing unauthorized disclosure of classified information. And fourthly and finally, through failing to recognize that unauthorized disclosure in the public interest deserves special protection. Please note, and you'll get the full submission, in each case, we've made concrete recommendations to deal with these concerns, and we're happy to discuss them. I'm going to deal with each of those assertions that I make in a little bit more detail. Why will there be overclassification? Firstly, the definition of the national interest used to justify classification is overbroad, as others have said. And we have some answers to the questions. that the committee has raised about national security, about definitions. Secondly, using the terms may be harmful, may prejudice, sets no lower limits on the probability of harm. Something that is 1% or 0.1% likely to cause harm would fall within the parameters. And we agree with the submission made earlier about a better formulation, particularly from Abusa. Thirdly, the very low threshold for classification of commercial information will open the way for restrictions on the disclosure of commercial information at all levels of government. This will impact negatively on competitiveness and accountability in tendering and other government business. Fourthly, there's a wide distribution of the right to classify. Wide ranges of institutions may classify, and people far down the chain of command can be delegated the right to classify. That's going to lead to a lack of control of classification and inconsistencies in approach. Finally, there's an inherent problem with the classification of categories of information, and those problems are being dealt with. On the second point, why are the safeguards insufficient? Firstly, the principles which provide the major bedrock of the safeguards are subjective and they're self-applied. There's no independent monitoring or appeal process. Secondly, applying the bill's classification process properly is onerous, and it will therefore be poorly applied in practice. The kinds of submissions we've heard about PIA will apply with even more force to this bill, which has a lot of more complicated set of deliberative steps embodied in making the classification decision. Thirdly, challenging classifications through the courts is expensive and time-consuming and has very little impact on weaknesses in the overall system. You might get one piece of information, but you won't affect the problems of the classification system itself. To deal with the third issue, criminalisation, what's wrong with the bill's big stick approach? Firstly, it penalises unauthorised possession or disclosure, even if there's no intent to prejudice the national interest. Secondly, it makes members of the public or journalists as liable as those who abuse their authorised access to disclose classified information. The possessor and the publisher are as guilty as the leaker. Thirdly, it shifts the onus, even an indirect way. It shifts the onus for keeping secrets secret away from the official secret keepers and onto the public and others who may come into contact with them. Fourthly, it criminalizes the unauthorized disclosure of state information, even if the information has not been formally classified, but may be said or may be argued to fall within the classification definitions. And finally, there are very harsh penalties attached to relatively low levels of potential harm to the national interest. Finally, why should unauthorized disclosure in the public interest be protected from criminal sanction? Firstly, this is a core recommendation from us that goes to the heart of undoing much of the bill's potential for harm. And again, our submission is not that this should primarily to journalists, it should be applied to anybody who makes an unauthorized disclosure in a bona fide public interest manner. And we can provide some discussion about what is the public interest. Secondly, it may be that non-disclosure of some classified information is more of a threat to the national interest or national security than disclosure. For example, if classified security warnings about security at the airport, for instance, have gone unheeded and unattended, it may be in the national interest to disclose them. Perhaps NEO prepared a report based on an assessment of security. And that report has been sitting gathering dust for a year. That would not have been in a public interest, because that report should be disclosed at the time it was prepared. But a year later, when perhaps because powerful interests have interest in the company providing security at the airport, nothing has been done to act on that, then perhaps it is in the public interest for that report to be leaked and disclosed. It may be that a fraud on the government or the public is disclosed via the disclosure of classified information. And a point we need to make about Section 22, the prohibition on improper classification is no answer to the need for disclosure in the public interest. Such information is, in most cases, or in many cases, would be properly classified. The fact that there is an irregularity, or there is corruption, etc., often emerges from a complex mosaic of information, which might include that classified document. But the original classifier is not necessarily going to jump out at him that an offence or some other unlawful action is being concealed by that classification. The Promotion of Access to Information Act also recognizes the imperative to disclose information that is of vital public interest. So that concept, that principle at least, is already there in a related piece of legislation. And finally, as the Ministerial Review Commission puts it, in a democratic society, some prejudice arising from the disclosure of information, the unauthorized disclosure of information, has to be tolerated in the interest of freedom, accountability, and transparent governance. The test of a bona fide public interest sets a reasonable boundary, we think, for such breaches, and we can talk more about that. In concluding, we urge the committee to embrace maximum openness and tame the elephant.
The suggestion is maximum exposure. Your questions. Mr. Searle shocked him. Any questions?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all I can say is that.
Questions.
Would you say that what you are arguing is consonant with the Constitution and its unusual emphasis on openness in every respect, whether we're dealing with freedom of speech or open justice in court?
I think that's a leading question. But anyway. Look, while we do not request special treatment for journalists, and indeed in the Constitutional Court rulings about the role of the media, the Constitutional Court has, in a sense, seen journalists and the media as the embodiment of the or exercising the rights that every citizen has the right to exercise. But maybe in our main submission, the court has also recognised the special role which the media plays within a democracy to provide the flow of information that is the foundation stone of proper political activity and informed political enterprise within the community. And it's also pointed out in the case that I referred to in the submission that it's not just the role of the media to report. It's also the role of the media to investigate, to interrogate, to uncover. And the court has quoted with approval that role of the media. And that specific duty, constitutional duty imposed on the media, does often place us on a collision course with those who want to keep things covered and closed. And that's why this bill is of particular concern to us. If I can also deal with some ideas about the public interest and national security if you want.
Thank you. I see some more hands now. The Honourable Claire has been at the catch one.
I'm just worried about the elephant part. And because if I get worried, I'm more worried about the Krimi now, the chin. I don't know if it's good. Aspects of the of the deal, I'm not sure I'm correct. But I'm not sure, because just a quick brown, I'm not sure whether the other laws in other countries, they criminalize all these things. What's your take on that? What's your reading of the international trend on this? What are people from the media? disclosure, I don't think there's any country which allows disclosure by information. They criminalize, they punish you. Whether in America, whether in Canada, whether in British territories or New Zealand, they do punish you. If you so what do we advise? Well, I'm just worried about this elephant, how we tame it, and what experiences should we get follow in terms of international practice in taming the elephant.
There,
my goal.
So I will not offer to tame the elephant. I would like Mr. Sol to speak to paragraph 36 of his written submission, which goes about the national interest of the public. In particular, recommendation 1A, just some explanation of that recommendation. And he was here before lunch when I spoke about the way I can argue anything from free trade, anything else to do matters of national security, and bearing that in mind, just to explain how that would, this recommendation 1A would address that whole thing. Thank you, Jack.
Any more questions? Can I ask a question, Mr.
If I can remember more than two questions.
Can I also ask one?
Please do, Jack.
Does the media have to behave in the public interest?
I'm going to have to answer that.
And if I might ask another one, is there a difference between the national interest and the public interest? What is the difference? And if it is your case that you must act in the public interest, is it your case that only the media should act in the public interest, or is it possible for the government or the legislature also to act in the public interest? Not in the national, in the public interest.
All right, to take all of those, I think, related questions. Firstly, we're not saying that unauthorized disclosure should not be criminalized. As you point out, every country applies some sanctions to unauthorized disclosure of classified information. What we are saying is that there needs to be a defense put up in the bill that can be used to justify and protect the perpetrator in certain circumstances. From having to suffer the consequences of that unauthorized disclosure. And the defense that we've put up, or that we've suggested, is a bona fide act in the public interest. And we've got, I think it was read out earlier, we've got a formulation that would apply to section 40, I think 45 and 46, I may correct me if I'm wrong. So it's not a question that the media or anybody else is going to be exempt. And to answer your question, Chair, yes, it may be possible for members of parliament, for anybody. That's why we say we don't single ourselves out. The MP who has brought a classified document that discloses some kind of unlawfulness, and does not hand it back, and so on, does not act in terms of the law, okay, also requires protection. It's not only journalists who are faced with this kind of situation. As somebody pointed out earlier, there are other non-governmental bodies, other institutions who deal with this sort of thing, who also require, in certain circumstances, that kind of protection. So I think one must not underestimate, it's not as if there's a free-for-all possible in terms of the proposal that we're making. A public interest override would merely, if I had a classified document and I decide, well, we must publish a story about this, I'm facing the prospect of 5 years in jail unless I can show that my decision was in the public interest. And in terms of definitions and so on in the public interest, the public interest is defined in the bill itself, rather widely. I can read the definition in the bill. But there are two ways of dealing with the public interest. It's something that it's a concept that the courts deal with and have quite a body of law developed over the years in terms of defamation law, in terms of privacy law. So it's not a concept that is alien to our criminal our justice system. Firstly, and secondly, if one wants to provide a greater degree of guideline. There's an example that I can read to members from the British Journalism Code, which sets out in a little bit more detail what might be considered factors in the public interest. One could also look to the Bill's own Section 22, where it looks at the factors that should not be considered in terms of classification to conceal an unlawful act, to prevent embarrassment, etc. Those list of factors might also be considered as defining if the disclosure would expose that having happened. Those factors which would perhaps make up a defining parameter as to what constitutes the public interest. The point that we're making is that the initial classifier may very well, in good faith, because of he only has what is in front of him on a document, classify correctly a document, which later may actually also pass the test that it should be disclosed in the public interest. So the fact that there's no protection in the Bill's provisions for a malafide classification, because most of the time the documents in terms of the Bill that might become a matter of public interest disclosure will have been correctly classified. I'm not sure if I've answered all the questions. Yes. The question of national interest and national security. There is a difference. The problem that we have with the definition of the bill is it's motherhood and apple pie. Almost anything that in the subjective opinion of the classifier has the potential to harm the general good of the community in some way may be classified, and the problem with that is it's very much too broad. National security is a more restrictive term, and again, I can read from the American executive order, which sets out what can be considered for classification, and this is George Bush who we're talking about. This is not somebody whose relationship with the whole security structure is one that's in conflict. That executive order says classification categories. Information shall not be considered for classification unless it concerns A, military plans, weapon systems or operations, B, foreign government information,
see intelligence activities, including special activities, intelligence sources or methods, or cryptology. D, foreign relations or foreign activities of the United States, including confidential sources. E, scientific, technological, or economic matters relating to the national security, which includes defense against transnational terrorism. F, United States government programming, programs for safeguarding nuclear materials or facilities. G, vulnerabilities or capabilities of systems, installations, infrastructures, projects, plans, or protection services relating to the national security, which includes defense against transnational terrorism. Or H, weapons of mass destruction. So it is possible to define national security in a much more restrictive manner. And to deal with the question that Dr. Tuele asked earlier, what have we got against the national interest? And I think the problem is what may damage the short-term national interest in the very broad definition of the bill. If those things are withheld, may lead to much greater long-term damage to the actual democratic health of the whole system. To take an example where Advocate White was thinking in terms of influence on the exchange rate of the economy or whatever. If one took the statement made by Investec recently. Now, in terms of the kinds of definitions that are in this bill, that statement might very well have fallen foul of a consideration of what was against, what provided for some harm to the national interest. Okay, I think it would be much more difficult to argue that harmed the national security. We are talking about fine distinctions, but it's important that those distinctions are made.
You got a question there?
Yeah. Could I ask something to do? Do you think there's a distinction ought to be drawn between criminalizing leakage or disclosure or the making available of information with intent to prejudice etc. Do you think there's a difference between that and publishing? Because, I mean, the information I have is that the United States didn't for more than 200 years make punishable the publication by the press of official secrets. That no doubt has changed under Bush, but I mean, that Milo has the information. And this was the result of a pitched battle in Congress at a time of war. 1917, Congress voted against the idea of making punishable the press disclosure, as opposed to leaking. I mean, if you have secrets, you obviously believe it's they're leaking. Do you not think there's a distinction there? I mean, the vote in front of us in fact deals with words as disclosure, 45 as protection in all impact in respect of the media, although we've heard argument, and I think correctly, that 40 might also come into play, and I would think quite problematically. The public interest defense that we've all been talking about applies to everybody, obviously. It's not for the media. It should be there. I'm sorry, I'm not doing this, Jay has disappeared from its own accord. But I mean, to me, it's a legitimate question. What is the criminalized publication by the press of at all?
No, I tend to agree there is a distinction, and that's one of the problems we have with the bill, is that it criminalizes all down the chain of disclosure. Every person who's played a part in that chain, from the original leaker to somebody who's aided or abetted the process or publishes or possesses. There's a problem with that. And I think if the committee wants to look at some fairly fundamental restructuring of the underlying principles of the bill, we looked at the New Zealand legislation, which distinguishes between classification as a method for deciding on how state information should be handled and who should have access to it, and possibly with regard to internal departmental sanctions about breaches of that, and the criminalization of disclosure, which is handled completely separately and sets a much higher test in terms of what you have to be seen to do and your intent and the level of damage involved in the disclosure before it becomes a crime. So they separate the question of we need ways to assist people to classify information and to assist people within the state how to manage that, how to grant access to it, authorize access, etc. And then separately we consider, well, what kind of public sanction in the non-state realm do we think is appropriate for breaches by whoever? And we've given the legislation in our submission from New Zealand, and we think that strikes a much better balance between the need and the justifiable need to keep something secret in the public interest, and the need to, in some circumstances, allow a degree of unauthorized disclosure.
Honourable members, is that it? There's no further questions, Mr. Sowers. Thank you, the Mailing Guardian, very much for coming to make this presentation. I'm sure the members have only just received, myself, I've only just received it, but I'm sure we will give it further consideration when we deliberate on the bill. Thank you very much again for coming today, spending time with us. We shall now go over to Advocate Cottier from the South African Catholic Bishops Conference. Understanding his question. Do you want to present from there, Advocate?
I'm happy to present from here, Chairperson. Thank you.
There be no objections, you shall then continue, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the committee.
Just before you proceed, I think you're a bit late, Advocate. You might have not heard the House rules. We would like you just to spend 7 minutes or so just to give us some of the main points of interest. And then give the committee some time to interact with you and on some of the issues that you have in your written submission.
Yes, Justice, and the committee clerk did convey those rules to us. Thank you. So I will be quick and brief, and I won't waste time on too many introductory remarks, but I do want to say that we drew up our submission on the basis of the gazetted version of the bill back in March. And there have been some changes, particularly to clause numbers and so on, so I may jump around a little bit for that reason. Firstly, as you said in the written submission, we recognize the need, broadly speaking, for legislation of this kind. The question for us, as I think it probably has been for a number of the other people who've made submissions, is one of balance, of reach, of scope. How far can such a statute legitimately go in a constitutional state with a number of individual freedoms at stake? And we feel that there are certain respects in which this bill does go too far and starts to unjustifiably limit or violate rights. And I want to just go through them very briefly and also mention one or two other problems that we have. And there are quite a few, for example, where there's a question of vagueness or uncertainty about certain terms. So, for example, the intrinsic value approach. I've looked at that backwards and forwards and from either side, and I still can't really make much sense of what that is intended to mean. And as with most vague definitions, when an attempt is then made to unpack it and define it even more closely, just also set even further. So, for example, we're told that it demands a reasoned and rational approach to determination. Surely any administrative decision must have a reasoned and rational approach. So that doesn't really add to our understanding of this intrinsic value approach. Then, clause 8.2, we see that this approach sets up what we regard as an undesirable kind of rivalry between, on the one hand, effective administration of government and legitimate governmental requirements, and the rights of individuals. Our approach would be that the rights of individuals must have priority, and that legitimate government interests or requirements and the effective administration of government must be shown to be justifiably encroaching on the individual rights. They are not of equal value. The one must take precedence over the other, and I think that 8.2b, in speaking of a balance, has the wrong approach there. 8.3b.2 is another example of a clause which has, as far as we can see, no real meaning, an appreciation of the inherent and essential utility and significance of the information. It seems to be open to all sorts of interpretations, and we have to consider that ultimately decisions and determinations are going to be made by officials at various levels of the state. Perhaps they're going to have to take them quite quickly. They're going to have to be dealing with requests for information and so on. Are they really going to be able to find these definitions useful? Do they really provide any kind of clarity? And conversely, when you're out there as a member of the public or a member of the media or whatever, and you want to know whether you're allowed to disclose a piece of information or how you should go looking for it or what the criteria might be to justify your search or your request, again, you're going to have to deal with some of these very vague definitions. Now, I think quite a lot of work needs to be done to tighten them up and to clarify them and to make them useful. We do suggest that Clause 8 of the bill, in fact, could just be dropped out and in no way weaken the bill or hamper its execution. There's already been obviously quite a lot of talk around national interest and national security. I note that there is a difference in the new version of the bill when it comes to the definition of national interest, and that some of the broader and more, if I may say, outrageous notions that national interest includes all those things of benefit to the Republic, that has been removed, so that's encouraging. We've mentioned the question of ideological bias, and this pops up in 15.1b. Sorry, 15.2b. That the national interest includes such things as economic growth and free trade. Now, I think there's some very respectable ideologies, some of them well represented in this house, that don't necessarily be that free trade is a good thing. There's a certain school of thought that says the pursuit of economic growth as a priority is not necessarily a good thing. So this is what I'm calling a kind of ideological bias. I suspect that these things have been dropped in there without having been properly thought through, and obviously it's the duty of the committee to do the thinking then. Is free trade, as opposed to the broad notion of trade relations, perhaps, what is really meant here? I'll move on to the question of national security. When we drafted the submission, there was no definition provided in the this is in the gazetted version. I see there is one now. And at first glance, from our perspective, it seems all right. I think one could have little objection to including in that definition acts of foreign intervention, terrorism, espionage, which then also requires a comma after it, and sabotage. Violence starts to get a little bit difficult again, because where's the limit? And once again, we're looking at an overbroad kind of definition here. Is each and every act of violence that happens in the Republic directed from or committed within the Republic or not? Now, where are you going to draw the line? Clearly, it's not meant to refer to individual acts of violence. Clearly, it's meant to be violence connected with foreign hostility or large-scale terrorism or espionage. Again, we need some sort of a tightening up there to make it really a useful definition. Paragraph 10 of our submission deals with the principles of classification. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through that one. Then the method of classifying information. The chief concern here is the provision for classifying whole file blocks, file series and categories and so on. Again, unless we were mistaken in our understanding, it seems to be an administrative convenience that because there may be some classifiable, in effect, secret information in a file series, we'll just classify the whole file series. Now, that cannot be justified. Again, it tends to prioritize secrecy and administrative convenience rather than the right to information. And the right to information is the constitutionally protected one that must have priority. So this needs to be reversed. A thing becomes classifiable if it itself is deserving of classification and warrants classification, not because it happens to be found within a particular block or series where there are other classified things. The appeal procedure, which is now dealt with in Clause 32, we make the simple point that the minister in this instance cannot be thought of as a disinterested party. It appears to us to be the wrong person or entity to deal with an appeal. We must have some sort of outside intervention here. If a person is aggrieved by the decisions of the servants of the minister at a very high level, a person cannot have much faith that the minister will automatically have a very objective view there. So some sort of a board, appeal board, which one has in many, many other instances, should be instituted perhaps to deal with appeal. Similar consideration around the role of the National Intelligence Agency. And this is not again to suggest that people are going to be willfully mischievous about how they behave or that they have hidden agendas or whatever. But the NIA, its whole ethos and culture, understandably, is one of keeping things secret. That's why it's there. It's not in the business of promoting the free flow of information. So one would want to see a very, very limited role, if any, for the NIA in the monitoring and inspecting and providing advice and support here. Maybe it calls for a certain amount of balance, rather than just the NIA giving advice to state entities about how to preserve their secrets. We need another body also to give them advice on the limits to which they may keep things secret. A body which, in other words, is there to promote the free flow of information. And I think those are then the specific points which we intended to raise. As I said, we recognize the need for this kind of law. We think that in this case, in too many ways, it goes too far. And certainly, in certain instances, it is far too vague to be obvious. I hope I kept within the 7 minutes.
Advocate, honorable member, I see the honorable much. Can I have your questions? Just before you go, I've got Honorable Smuts and the Honorable Doctor down there. Anybody else? We'll take those two questions in the meantime.
Can I do one little one before I get to everyone? You would agree, would you, that this idea of classifying entire categories of information is contrary, and it's good that we haven't spoken about it, everybody takes it for granted. It is contrary to Section 32 of the Constitution. All information held by the state is there for us citizens. And the principle of severability, would you agree, has been built into every other law and into the practice of the court. And this is unique, this approach of categorizing entire categories. Now, you said an interesting thing, which I'd like to agree with and then ask you some further ones. You said you would delete Clause 8, the intrinsic value approach. Would you also, because I read this act with a pen in my hand and I want to delete Clause 4, information? Why do we need it? Especially when it still includes conversations and mutterings and opinions and intellectual knowledge, which I think had been meant to come out. Well, why can't we delete the next one, Clause 5, state information, the one after that, and get right to the point which is supposed, on my view, is supposed to be about national security, really. Instead of trying to deal with the holding of information amongst a whole range of organizations, and it seems to me there must be other entities, agencies, or departments that teach departments how to file, and how you don't chuck stuff away, and you don't just shred. And then while one's about it, one could delete clause 11, and clause 12, and clause 13, and just get right down to the actual point. It would also help the confused officials whom the delete describes so vividly. If we want this thing to work, then I can't help wondering, but do you not think that the Public Service Commission might be better for helping people with filing?
Was there a question there?
Whether he would delete clauses. 4, 5, 6, 11, 12, 13.
I got the question.
I'll keep the answer short. I might, if I push my mind to those particular clauses. I do think that sometimes there is a value in the kind of clause, and this is very much off the top of my head, such as 4, which sets out some sort of a list of what constitutes information for the purposes of the Act. Yes, it might end up being perhaps a little bit more confusing, but I think there are instances where this sort of thing does help to give an indication of what it's about. But I don't want to say off the cuff that yes, I would agree that I would want those particular clauses to be deleted. I think the difference between them and 8 was that 8 really introduces this completely amorphous concept. It's a strange thing. No one knows what it means. Well, maybe some people know what it means, but its meaning is not apparent from the Act. And I don't think it adds anything to the Act. It doesn't help. There may be items in 4, 5, 6 and elsewhere which are helpful, but maybe they could do with a lot of trimming down. And as far as the earlier point was made, certainly I think that some of the stuff is certainly not going to stand constitutional scrutiny. I mean, I cannot imagine a court upholding a decision that says, well, we're not going to respond to a query because every file in that particular room or building is in a series where there may be something secret. Clearly a court is going to say, look, open it up, take away the secret stuff and give people access. So certainly that provision needs to be rethought.
It wants to put a question to you.
No, mine is about your objection for NIA playing a filer and supervisory role. And in the case where they are suggesting an independent body to do this. And I'd like to elaborate on this because I think earlier submission said this is not about access to information, this is about protection of secret and sensitive information. And our understanding, the only agent which has got a counterintelligence mandate is NIA, and there's no other agency. what type of independent board are you envisaging here? Is there a new structure, some independent appointed? And what capacity would you put in those independent bodies to advise and to this monitoring?
I think the point is taken that the statute is about the protection of information. But in seeking some sort of a balance, you don't want a situation in which the whole approach from beginning to end is dominated by the need to protect, by where the default position will be, let's protect, let's hide, let's keep secret. It shouldn't be, if I quote, for example, from 37, where is it from? 37.1. Yeah, most of 37.1 provisions. NIA is given the task of providing expert support and advice. Well, note the word advice to organs of state which require assistance in the handling of requests for the review of the state's classified and delegated information. I would suggest that an agency like NIA is going to start from the point of view in giving that advice of, well, you've classified this, you've kept it secret, let's keep it that way. That's the ethos, that's the starting point. And I'm calling for some sort of a balance there, where there is some other body, entity or kinds of advice which might come from the opposite direction and say, well, is this a justifiable classification in the first place? Maybe it would advise the organization to in fact release or make available that information. I think that there are quite a few examples of statutory boards and bodies and so on. The Film and Publications Board, for example, is one which is charged with keeping an eye on a certain kind of information, not from the standpoint of let everything go and we will just, you know, every now and then intervene and keep something back, and also not from the standpoint of let's have maximum restriction and only allow out the bare minimum. I think the Film Publications Board does things with a really good kind of balance and subject to all sorts of definitions and statutory requirements and so on. And I don't think that too many people would complain that it carried out its work in a way that was biased or prejudicial or whatever. But I can't see a reason why there shouldn't be some sort of a board. I'm not going to try to come up with a name for it, the Information Review Board or something, which would not be dominated by, as I said, the ethos and the culture of secrecy. That's the concern, that kind of domination.
I'm not a member there, that's it. Advocate, where are the bishops?
I hope they're all in the diocese.
Who are the bishops?
That's unfair.
No, we know the ETV, it's the media. I'm particularly interested that the bishops were interested in this piece of legislation. It's very interesting.
Well, if you'll give me 2 minutes, I'll give you the background.
2 minutes?
Yeah. That's what I usually do at the beginning of the submission, but given the 7 minute rule, I didn't do it today. Our office, the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office, has been going since 1997. We're an office of the Bishops' Conference, which is the sort of structure of the Catholic Church in this country. We make submissions to Parliament. We write briefing papers for the church leadership on political developments, legislation, etc., etc. So we were here yesterday making a submission on floor crossing. We've just delivered our submissions on the DSO legislation, the National Conventional Arms Control Amendment Bill, etc., etc. We've done hundreds. We don't often appear before intelligence committees, although I think there are a number of individual members who may be familiar with our submissions and other things. The bishops don't know much about legislation. So they employ people like me, like my two colleagues at the back there who are researchers in our office. And we come up with our analysis of legislation in the light of what we understand to be the Church's position. We consult with bishops, theologians, and others to determine where we stand on an issue. And we draw up a submission like this, and we come along and present it. Occasionally, we manage to persuade a bishop in person to come along and present himself in all his finery. But that's really just for show. That's who we are.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Advocate. I must thank you for coming. I was very, very curious about this conference of yours, but thank you for the explanation. Thank you very much for your very short and concise presentation. Honourable members, I got good news. There's tea, that's the good news. There's not so good news. We're going to start immediately after that announcement that there's tea. And we're going to go over to the last presentation. The presenter is here. Those of you that would like tea, it is outside there. I think you can just go pick your tea up and come in. And then we can go on immediately. If there's no objections to that procedure, I shall adopt that procedure immediately. The presenter wants to get a tea, so I think I'll indulge him just to get a cup of tea with the additional rider that you come back immediately. Thank you.
Submission as a member of the public, having retired from government in October last year. But I do so drawing on nearly 13 years' experience in government and the intelligence community, 5 years in the South African Secret Service, 3.5 years in the National Intelligence Agency, 2 years at Home Affairs, and 2.5 years before I retired as Coordinator for Intelligence. Chair, I have approached the committee for permission to make a representation because I have been watching the public debate, and I believe that the public debate on this bill misses a number of key perspectives, and I hope I can be of some assistance to the committee by highlighting these. There is a misconception, firstly, and this has come out clearly again in today's presentation, that the purpose of protection of information legislation is to protect government information from the public. This is just not true. The real purpose is, in the main, to protect such information from the nation's adversaries. The public, so to speak, is just an innocent bystander. Information made available to the public becomes available to our adversaries. Section 22(1)(i)(4) of the draft bill recognizes this by specifying that one of the factors that must be assessed and weighed in classification decisions is, quote, the value of information to adversaries, unquote. Who are these adversaries? They are other governments, firstly, who seek to have insight into and influence our thinking, decisions, and actions in order to advantage themselves in their dealings with us. They are domestic entities that oppose the democratic order and seek to subvert, sabotage, or undermine government processes in doing so. They are the criminals, the corrupt, the extremists. Government has a responsibility to protect the integrity of its processes against such adversaries on behalf of the public. The public is not the adversary. This draft legislation grows out of a number of de facto realities. The first of these is that South Africa is the target of vociferous espionage from a wide range of foreign countries, large and small, from organized crime syndicates, from right-wing extremists, from the private security and intelligence industry, and from a range of other entities who seek undue advantage in their dealings with government. The second reality is that information security in government has been woefully inadequate. I often tell the story that towards the end of my tenure in the National Intelligence Agency, I was responsible for signing off on a highly critical information security audit of the Department of Home Affairs. And a month later, the report landed on my desk as the new DG of Home Affairs. It was the atrocious lack of information security in the Department of Home Affairs that allowed its internal processes to be seriously subverted in the issuing of fraudulent IDs, passports, and other documentation. The third de facto reality is that the government has been implementing many of the measures contained in the draft bill as a matter of course. In other words, the bill is not proposing something new in the main. Information is being classified. There are rules governing the handling of such classified information. The National Intelligence Agency has long had the responsibility to monitor, advise on information security in government. But all this has been done largely in an ad hoc, hand-to-mouth, unstructured way, utilizing the minimum information security standards. And one of the greatest challenges government faced is that these standards were not properly enforceable, as they had no legislative status, as has been noted today. The other challenge was that there was no statutory crime of espionage, and that we were working with outdated apartheid-era protection of information legislation that did not take into account the new realities and constitutional imperatives of a democratic South Africa. Arising out of these realities was the fact that classification was either not done at all, or information was overclassified. There was no process to declassify information, and no checks and balances in the information protection processes. This draft protection of information bill arises out of a long and sincere process to address these challenges. This process sought firstly to align our protection of information legislation with the Constitution, the PAIA, and other information-related legislation. It sought to provide an overarching system of information protection. It sought to provide for a clear set of processes for the declassification of information. It sought to provide for as clear a set of principles and procedures as is humanly possible for the protection of information, and it sought to provide for the monitoring and oversight of these procedures. The internal government processes that led to the formulation of the bill now before Parliament have been long and painstaking. I happen to have chaired the task team established by Minister Casuals in 2005 on the review of intelligence-related legislation. The task team, amongst many other things, considered the report from the Commission on Classification and Declassification that had been set up by the former Minister for Intelligence Services, Lindi Sisulu. It also considered representations from the National Intelligence Agency on the need to introduce regulations on information security in government in order to give teeth to the myth. It looked at the Protection of Information Act of 1982 and found it totally unsuitable for our new constitutional and legislative imperatives. This in turn led to the establishment of an interdepartmental task team consisting of a wide range of government departments, not just from the security cluster, but including the National Archives and others. And the team also drew on the expertise and perspectives of outside senior counsel and esteemed academics who had no excessive secrecy axe to grind. The bill that has emerged from this process is, in my view, an extremely fair and even attempt to balance the imperatives on secrecy and transparency. Much of the criticism of the bill seems to be premised on the belief that some of its provisions are open to abuse. This may be true, but it is equally true for all powers that this legislature confers on government. It is not humanly possible to craft legislation that is abuse-proof. It is our system of accountability and checks and balances that must prevent and catch out abuse. The reality is that the current lack of a clear system for the protection of government information that is not premised on the need to balance secrecy and transparency is indeed abused, not necessarily through evil intent, but largely through the decades-long setting in of bad habit. This bill seeks to break the bad habits, and in the words of the bill itself in Section 2D, quote, provide for a thorough and methodical approach to the determination of which state information may be protected, unquote. Particular concern has been expressed about the broad definition of national interest. In my experience, it is nigh impossible to come up with a definition of national interest that will satisfy everyone. I might add, it will be more difficult to come up with a definition of public interest. Some have suggested that we limit the reasons for classification to national security, but for me this is inadequate. There are many instances when government can justifiably protect information that is not strictly of national security concern. For example, when government is engaging in trade negotiations, it must surely be allowed to protect information about its negotiating positions in order to prevent giving advantage to those it is negotiating with and thus undermining the national interest to get the best trade as possible. Such negotiating information cannot strictly be regarded as of national security importance, although I take Advocate Swart's point if we define national security more broadly. National interest is a term that adequately covers such issues and must of necessity be broadly defined so as to catch all such issues, which it would be impossible to predict in a more tightly defined legislation. In my view, the broad definition of national interest provides merely a framework for the conceptual justification of protection of information. The flesh to this framework is given by the more precise criteria for classification given in other parts of the bill and in the standards and regulations that will flow from the bill. I focused on the submission on the broad defense of this bill. While I was involved in overseeing the process that led to the birth of this bill, I was not intimately involved in its formulation. And I've not really addressed any specific concerns or comments on sections of the bill. However, in concluding, I do want to draw Parliament's attention to one issue, but I want to add another one that is occurred to me while we've been listening, Chair, which I think the bill does not address. That is the right to privacy as a criterion for classification. Now, I'm aware that there's other legislation relating to data protection and privacy in the process, but I still think this bill needs to address it. Section 17 of the bill defines personal information as, quote, any information concerning an identifiable special person which is disclosed could reasonably be expected to endanger the life or physical safety or general welfare of an individual. Section 21, in giving grounds for classifying information as confidential, does not include personal information, as it does for secret and top secret classification. And Section 22.1b.3 of the bill says that classification of information may not, under any circumstances, be used to prevent embarrassment to a person, etc. In my experience, it is generally common practice in government departments to, for instance, classify personal information held about employees or other citizens as confidential in order to protect their privacy. I think this is necessary and right, and I think the bill should allow for the classification of such personal information as confidential. Secondly, by disallowing the classification of information to prevent embarrassment to a person, the bill prevents government from protecting people's rights to privacy and dignity. A clear example of this would be the information held by the National Intelligence Agency about persons collected during the conduct of security clearances. Such information often includes information about private lives, relationships, habits, etc. Not being allowed to classify this information on the grounds of possible embarrassment to the individuals concerned is, I believe, a subversion of their right to privacy and dignity. The second concern, Chair, which has occurred to me while listening to the deliberations today, is in an earlier version of the bill, there was provision for the protection of non-documented information, I think it was called designated information, which I'm informed the state law advisors advised the drafters to remove. I have a concern, Chair, that this would mean that the bill or the act, when it becomes an act, would only be able to deal with the illegal disclosure of documented information. And let me give an example why I think this is problematic. Minutes of cabinet meetings, for example, are classified normally as top secret. It appears to me that while somebody who leaks a cabinet minute can get into trouble, somebody who leaks the discussion of that takes place in cabinet could not be dealt with in terms of this bill. And I think that's a problem. I'm told that the state law advisors thought that this would be very difficult to implement. But I would certainly want advice from my experience in government, Chair, both in the security and the non-security sector, that I think it is certainly possible and advisable that the contents of certain meetings are classified by a declaration at the beginning of the meeting that the contents of this discussion are classified. If the contents of the meeting meet the other criteria that's applied to documented information. Apart from members of a committee or cabinet, whatever, leaking information to the media for perhaps political interests, it means that if that is not covered, that a member of cabinet, God forbid this would never happen, is recruited to spy for a foreign intelligence service, would be quite within the law to go and meet his handler or her handler after the cabinet meeting, report everything that went on verbally, and not have broken the law. And espionage doesn't just take place through the passing over of documents. It takes place through giving insights into internal government processes that may not be documented. And I would ask the committee to consider some way of tackling this in the legislation. I thank you for your attention, and I commend the bill to the committee.
Honourable members, can I have your question? I recognise the advocate's one. I see the Honourable Capitelli. Shall we take those questions in the meantime?
Thanks, Chair. Well, I'm only going to start with this designated thing. It's going to be another debate, but I need to step there or to touch there. Are you of the opinion that if I read the contents of a top secret document, knowing fully well that it's top secret, and I walk out of the door and I relay that information to an outside person, that act would not be covered in this law, as it is at the moment. In the same way that if a cabinet, if a minister cabinet meeting is classified as top secret, for me to walk out of that and to discuss it with somebody would mean that I would convey information out of a top secret classified document. Would I not fall within the ambit of this act in terms of offences? Because the point you're making is very valid. And that's why initially when you start talking about this, this information, you said, well, if you at the start of a meeting, you would declare that meeting to be top secret and the minutes would indicate such that it would comply with all the other things. Well, those are one of the few things that I can think of in designated information as it was in the initial bill could be argued to be practically enforceable or able to handle it. But there are so many other things, non-documented things, that there's no way that you can implement it because the burden of proof that the person who talked about this must have known and all those things is very difficult. How can you say something is classified when you talk about the conversation? There's one person, the word of one person against the other in terms of that. But so I would rather not try to go there. But in particular, the examples I just used now in terms of the classified minutes or the classified document that I take something out and convey it verbally to somebody else. I just want to know if you think that escaped the application of this law.
Thank you, Chair. My early plea still stands. But my hand is up for the question. But I'm just reminding you that my early Mr. Gilda, thank you very much. But I want to find out from you, there is no top secret here, there is no classification, which is good for what I'm going to say. When you are talking about the national interest, when you are talking about the value of information to assessors and all that you have spoke about and other members or presenters have tried to talk about, how do you see the public, the South African nation, getting to know about the content of this? Because we will end up charging people who did not know that they were not supposed to tell an adversary because that person didn't know. For me, intelligence of this nature of this paper is straightforward for education of our people and other countries to get. For me, it's not just belonging to a particular corner of people who are working for intelligence. It's knowledge that our people don't have. And one presenter said they could, they end up being confused and afraid, you know. This can water down the confusion in the fear, because it is straightforward information that all members of the nation, if possible, can really get this. How can we arrange for such a thing, and how can we organize it is another question, one day. But I just want to find from you this. How do you think we cannot bury you before people know about this? Thank you.
The Honourable
Thanks for the presentation. You have raised these two issues which are really of concern. The first one, this right of to private. Really, I was expecting people from the media that they're going to raise this thing. Because many of the private intelligence organizations which are operating in South Africa. When our state agencies have to invade our rights, they have to go through a judge. But when these private intelligence organizations invade our rights, they go to know us. They just do it. And you are basically saying, no, there are other legislations which may protect individuals, but they still from that. If I remember very well, so maybe you can just highlight them. We've always been, even in this bill, told that there is a privacy bill which is coming. I think it's been coming since the 2000s. And I think from our perspective, we are playing oversight. We're very worried about this aspect of protecting the South Africans from abuse by these private intelligence organizations, invading their rights and privacy. any of you, do you think we do, are these legislation you're talking about, those may be important to us, are they adequate, or do we still have to wait for the law commission? Because I really don't know, maybe the chair will inquire on our behalf whether the commission has tabled the report on the secrecy bill, because even during the commissioner's death inquiry or committee, we're told that there's a privacy bill which is coming. There's a privacy bill, but the abuses continue. So I think that's one thing really we'll have to confront as we move on with this bill, how we protect exchange others. This designation is very good, you put it, but as other colleagues put, how do we narrow it so that it's not abused? Encompass or becoming unimplementable. I'm not saying tabulate it for us. Is it possible maybe to specify either in the regulations or which type of those meetings would be designated, classified? You've given a good example of cabinet meeting. But you can't just say any state meeting can be. We're preventing for just classifying every meeting. A person may just, because they can be turned up to be abused by the official where they classify those meetings as secret, all of them, all classified. Is it possible that we can work up a list of, or through the act or through the regulation to prevent that type of abuse with your experience, if you can advise? Thank you.
So Billy, if I might throw in something here for mine. The myth. You must have had a lot of experience with the implementation of the myth. Can you give us some idea of how government departments, departments of state reacted to the implementation of the myth? What was the understanding? How were they reacting to implementing it? Were they actually aware of this misdocument? And what was the significance of the misdocument in the intelligence community here? NIA had some role to play there. Can you just give us some background there on this misdocument?
Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. If I can start with the Honourable Patrick Swart's question. I think perhaps, Advocate, you misunderstood my point. Obviously, conveying verbally the contents of a classified document is the same as revealing the document. What I was talking about is conveying the discussions in a meeting which are not committed yet forever to paper, but which may deserve to be classified. I'm making the point that not all information that needs to be protected gets committed to paper. It might sometimes be necessary I'm going to use the term designate, but I don't remember the formulation in the original bill, so I don't know if I would have agreed with it, but I'll use that as a shortcut. It might be necessary to designate the fact, for example, of certain negotiations that government might be facilitating between conflicting parties in a conflict area in Africa, because the public knowledge of those discussions might undermine the confidence of the parties. They might, as has happened in the past, I'm still committed to my oath of secrecy, so I'm still could classify things in my head. I don't know what you do with them, Jay, because this act doesn't cover them. But I'm going to link that to Dr. Quirley's question, my second question. I would agree that it's impractical and undesirable to have a blanket designation of non-documented information. But I do think it's possible to identify certain types of information or circumstances which can be expressly classified. As I try to suggest, if the contents of a discussion of a cabinet meeting or a meeting of the management of National Intelligence Agency or the Department of Home Affairs for that matter is thought to contain information or discussion which would fall into the criteria for classification if it was committed to paper, to declare that this contents of these discussions are classified as confidential. And many meetings of top management of government departments, a lot of information would be confidential. You might be discussing certain staff issues, a whole range of issues, which would be unfair to the staff if it got out, amongst other things. Secondly, it might be possible to designate the fact that South Africa is facilitating negotiations between Hamas and Israel, that fact is designated. It's not, I mean, there might be documents arising out of the fact, but if somebody goes out and says we're facilitating Israel to talk to Hamas, so I'm saying there are circumstances which I don't think it would be that difficult, Chair, to narrow down and put in place formal procedures, either through some directive that is issued or through, as I think, beginning each such meeting with the declaration of its classification. I must stress I'm not saying this to increase the burden of secrecy against the public interest, but I think if we're going this far in this bill, we do need to take account that there is a lot of information that is not committed to paper or before it's committed to paper, which needs to be protected. Honourable Member, my paper is not classified. I didn't know there were plans to bury me. If you could let me know the date, I could make sure I meet the deadline. I understand the submission to be in the public domain, and I assume that the committee is making submissions publicly available. They're already available because I'm surrounded by journalists and lawyers.
I think Mr. Gilder, what the Honourable Member is saying more than that is, how do we educate the public? How do we get the public to hear and see what we're doing here? How do we get to interact with the public on this type of issues?
I think it's a very important point. I wasn't really meaning to be sounding facetious on this. I think that unfortunately the public discourse on this issue of secrecy versus transparency in this bill has been somewhat biased in my view. And the public has the impression out there, I think, from being a member of the public and I'm reading the media and listening and watching the media, that the aim of this bill is to keep the public the dark about what government is doing. And I think there needs to be, with the cooperation of the media, an attempt to give the public an understanding of what's going on. I think Parliament also has mechanisms. I think the intelligence community has a communication strategy which must take this into account. There is a series of public debates organized by the Institute for Security Studies, which I'm participating in, on this and related issues around the country at universities. I think those kinds of initiatives are very important. I think what the Institute of Security Studies is interestingly doing in promoting these debates is to try and encourage more public discussion and academic discourse on intelligence and related matters. And I think that's something that government intelligence community and the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence should be involved in encouraging. On question about the privacy issue. I don't know if the legislation being prepared would be adequate, but I think what's very important, and this also addresses some of the concerns raised by other presenters today, Chairperson, is that the purpose of classification within government is to provide government officials with a clear set of rules and procedures for how to handle documents or information that has been classified. How it should be prepared, what it should look like, who can be distributed to, how it should be stored, how it should be circulated, and so on. And that's really the main purpose. And that is the challenge that government has, that it has systems in place to protect information that should be protected. The bill does not allow information to be protected, classified as confidential personal information in order to protect the privacy of staff, for example. If I write a disciplinary letter to a member of my staff, I would mark that confidential. And I don't think that the legislation should remove that. It's got nothing to do with the person's personal safe, physical safety. It could be said to do with their well-being, but I think the protection of privacy in the way government deals with personnel records must be allowed. Whatever the privacy legislation ultimately says, privacy legislation is going to, as I understood it, because when I was at Home Affairs it was really under discussion, deal with access to records that government holds about citizens and so on. I think I've covered all the questions, Chair. Oh, sorry, your question now. Sorry, Chair. To put it bluntly, Chair, this was really a hit-and-miss attempt to put in place a policy which was not provided for adequately yet in law. Perhaps it was a shortcut to go to Cabinet and ask Cabinet to approve the policy. I think one of the presenters has made the point that it's moot as to whether this constituted an enforceable policy in law. And that precisely was the point that the intelligence community, and certainly when I was in NIA, it was part of my responsibility to oversee the implementation of this in government. And the challenge that we had at that time was precisely that it was not enforceable. And what we tried to do in the consultative fora of government, the cluster meetings and other fora, to get the rest of government to buy in by, for example, making certain provisions of them as part of the performance contracts of directors general. So it was done through persuasion rather than enforcement. And broadly in my time in government, not just in NIA, I saw a general improvement of the implementation of the prescripts of this, but still far from ideal. So there was a broad policy acceptance of the need for such standards, but it was very difficult to get implemented on the ground.
Okay, Ms. Is that it?
Two submissions that must apply to government departments, which to me is relevant to our whole discussion on the organs of state. Could I just ask, is that the case, or did it go a little wider than that? If so, where did it go wider, and on what argument or justification?
Thanks, Honourable Member Smith. It didn't go to the Natal Sharks Board, as far as I know. As far as I know, it wasn't applied to the Natal Sharks Board. Chairperson, I understand the Honourable Member's concern because it was raised in a seminar she spoke at that I attended on this bill, and she's raised it again today. without looking at the precise formulation of the legislation, I think the bill would have to allow the application to apply to any entity that can be considered part of the state. The extent of how that applies will depend on the entity. I think Honourable Member Swart had mentioned an example. MIS and the National Intelligence Agency's role in providing security advice and monitoring information security extended to a range of public entities. Not carte blanche, but as ESCOM and other entities which could, where lack of information security could impact on national security. So MIST was used in those cases too. But on a basis that was adjusted for the circumstance of that entity, not as a blanket.
If you allow me, I know we're finishing up, but just on that line, because I don't think we're going to get much better information from anybody giving us information about this whole organ of state thing. At the moment, the bill makes provision for all organs of state, be it the Waterberg, water, whatever the case may be, to be exempted by the minister. What would be the better way of doing that? There's some thought that because of the ability to classify that this will lead to classification all over, versus the thought that anybody that wouldn't see the need to classify would want to be exempted. What would be the better way to approach this whole thing from your point of view and of your history and involvement? Would it be to include everybody and then let the minister exempt some, or should you limit it to a specific grouping and make provision on show of good cause of the need of things to be classified to maybe include it on the prerogative of the minister upon application, which would make it a case in point that the water board maybe with blueprints of specific things that may be regarded as need to be classified will have to apply to be included instead of the sharks board with no need for that having to wait to be excluded. What would be the better way of addressing this whole thing of a blanket inclusion versus a more constructive inclusion? Let's talk about the three tiers of government and stop with all these other outside things, and then upon showing of good cause to be included.
Thanks, Chair Honourable Member. It's a kind of curveball, because I haven't really thought about it, but trying to think quickly as you asked your question, Honourable Member. In my experience, the reality that will emerge if and when this bill is enacted, is that the first implementation thrust will have to be a large-scale education or information program led by the National Intelligence Agency in order to clarify what are the implications practically for government departments and other entities. A number of entities who are sort of on the periphery, if you like, of government, including those at lower levels of government who might not be certain whether they hold any information, what information they hold should be classified, will need to have an opportunity to sit down and consult and get advice. And that advice would have to be determined by getting an insight into what kind of information that entity deals with. I would probably err on the side of making the bill inclusive and then excluding through that process rather than the other way around, because you want there to be certain obligations on such institutions to at least ascertain their status hold information which may fall into any of these categories. Now that would be my off-the-cuff inclination. But I would need to think about it.
One more, members. I think we've reached the end of the day. Allow me to thank the present presenters, all of you that were here today. I think it was very, very, very useful interacting with you. I would not want you leaving here thinking that the committee has already come to conclusions or that they have a pre-worked out manner in which this bill will be processed. It's not the case. We were very interested in hearing your presentations and learning from them. We will deliberate on this bill as time goes on. And again, I'd like to thank all of you very, very sincerely for your presentation. And to you also, Mr. Gilder, to the members of the public that are here, the members of the ministry, and all staff members, and also the honorable members for a very, very constrained behavior today. I must compliment you. Thank you, and this meeting stands adjourned. Just honorable members, we are meeting tomorrow morning at 9:454, the NCC bill. The meeting now stands adjourned.
Recognized, but you need to be recognized. Thank you. the morning. Now, what about in the morning? What time do you extend it? You extend it even if you complete it tomorrow afternoon, that's perfectly fine.
Okay.
Thank you so much. It's 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
They're having deliberations on the form of customary law of taxation. So, it's a very big deal for society. And you know a little bit about how it works. Yeah. So the
wife on the left hand and the wife on the right hand and the wife in the tree.
I would have, yeah.
And those are picked up along the way.
So these people for a shard sitting next to we've covered the portion of meeting today, the doubt with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you covered it now as well, did you?
No, I think the
So they had a briefing on it this morning and then they had some public submission.
Mm.
This morrow they can see in the ground line and then they'll work through the door.
10 o'clock,
you said? 10 o'clock. So you can just speak to him. Or you can just take one side.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can just talk to him.
What
time
are you
closing off? About 5 o'clock.
That's a few things. What I think is a bit security. I've got it for just 15 this month.
Yeah.
And I'm really. You people who have been doing this incredible work, you have been congratulated. You have done anything to do in your mind.
That's very good. Thank you very much. And this will be our top monitor's report that she will see a few pieces of communication.
Mm.
And I think she keeps an eye on that as well. So it's very good to know. I'll find very good to know. Thank you.
You mentioned just this morning, I'm just again tomorrow moving on the law of petition, that's a very charter law.
That's right.
The department figures suggested that I talk to you about that. Yeah, the department of the community principal and the person and
the book
to the book. So the community will discuss the further on that tomorrow.
Okay.
So tomorrow morning, if you need to, I'll just go to the document. Yeah, this one is to my.
Would you be here?
Yeah, I'm going to do that. It wasn't long, and tomorrow shouldn't be long.
Mm-hmm.
At least we decided to move on to get the issue, but the fact that I'm on the agenda shouldn't be long.
Oh my God. So they think that they're going to do in the afternoon whatever.
Exactly.
Oh.
Okay. So what's going to happen is that they come in and we're going to go into a committee meeting.
would experience Malaka. From that meeting, he would then have to write a portion, and then from that, he would then take the writing skill. Okay, and that means you have to keep your whole morning open. You have to keep the whole morning open. Okay, so you have to bring along with you your identity documents, as well as some writing material, and a practice for sound. So sound, if you have a practice, and you bring it along. Okay, and you just give your our date, tip number,
Nikki? Mm-hmm. Okay, then. Can you start this from my sister?
Hi, and I think this is Carol, please. I'm Carol, this is a call from the following to my sister. The following to find out to do the basic model of the answer.
J-E-U-R. J-E-U-R. Okay, mm. Because I saw this dot.
That's for the J.
Oh, okay. They just apply in the course. Thank you. Good afternoon, thank you. All right, I'm just hold for him. Maybe one of holding the line of step is a little bit of attention. Like still be the old hall again, sir? Okay. Or say, can I put him through to his assistant? To him. All right, sir. Just hold for him. I'm sorry, his line is still busy. I don't hold again. All right, sir. Okay, now it's fine. Thank you. No, he's going to hold till he got it. Somebody from Parliament. Oh, man. I think it's Patrick for me. Yeah, I think so, that voice. I just realized that voice now. Yeah. Chat. Thank you for holding your going through. Yes, then I spoke to Tameka and I found out they paid us. Yes, last year, I don't know what happened. Because their subscription is supposed to end in November 2008. And I'm sorry. Yes, but yes, I spoke to Tameka and I showed her how to go through into our site.
Right, up to Thank you.
call. I don't know, but they are meeting. But since you were on meeting, not too tomorrow. Maybe he bought it last week. Oh my God, I haven't done that battery.
So I'm not getting something tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay. So because I did. Yes, it's that picture, the one that you made. It's a picture like that.
Where is the two
one? With that one, it's also having the two ones. Both of that one, the three and the two ones.
Okay.
I don't know, I haven't been doing it myself since the afternoon.